searching for a reason to love. I was searching for a reason to love. But when I looked and saw your face, heaven opened up for me, and I knew just
someone's job and pay. When will we understand? No one will have a job if we destroy this land. No, 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 no. Someone's playing God. Deciding what should be alive and what should not. Someone plays with fire, but you know we're only building our own a funeral pyre. Happening is wrong, causing mass extinction while doctors use machines on human lives to prolong. Someone's playing God, deciding who should be alive and who should not.
I hadn't heard that song for a while. That's Alice Di Michele and from her Searching album. And they send that out to the family of Steve Schumann and all who loved him here in the greater Butte County area. He passed on last Sunday, and we are all miss him very much. My name is Chris. The show is called Peace and Justice. We are on with you every Friday from 11:30 to 1 with rotating hosts. Robert Jones will be the host next week. I have the honor to have on the phone with me Scott Rushing. Scott Rushing is a broker in Ventura. He and his wife Paula had two children. Normally, you would not expect a man in his demographic to become a fervent policing reformer. But his son, Tyler Rushing, was killed by the Chico Police Department on the night of July 23, 2017, and he has been dogged to find justice for his son ever since. We're going to be talking about Tyler, the night he was executed, and the details of the case, which have come to light from Scott's own investigation, but also from the work of Chico Soul editor and journalist Dave Waddell. Thank you for joining me today on the Peace and Justice Show, Scott Rushing. Hi.
Hello there. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're fine.
All right, good.
You know, I know that you have been working along with other aggrieved parents around Chico and around the country, and you and David Phillips, father of Desmond Phillips, went to a national rally in Washington, D.C. on August 28th of other families who had lost loved ones to officer-involved shootings. What commonality did you find?
Well, the interesting thing is, of course, the bonding that occurs at these events. These people from all over the country, there was all colors, all languages. Family members shared their stories, and I guess the point I would like to make is that even though every killing was different, Chris, the details of every killing was different. And it had its own set of circumstances and specific events that led to the killing. The pattern of the response of law enforcement was always the same. And that was to vilify the deceased. to vilify the family and to concentrate their efforts on what the victim did wrong and not what the police did wrong. And that was a common theme of these killings, and there were several hundred. About 100 people spoke, and David and I both spoke briefly to the crowd. There were about 500 people there at the Washington Monument. Mm-hmm. And this is the second national get-together, and we're doing one annually. But that's the big thing that I got from the event was the loss is overwhelming. The people, some of them could barely speak. Other family members would have to finish their talk. And the effect of losing a loved one to police is so much more impactful than a disease or a car accident or age or something more, you know, more predictable.
Yeah.
When someone is in your family is killed by a police officer, it's a tainted killing. There's always people that feel that your child or your brother, your sister did something wrong, that they aren't responsible. And the police feed into that. And that was the pattern that I saw. And it's obscene, it's appalling. And it's even more impactful when you hear it from people across the country.
Yeah. Well, I just want to let our listeners know that, you know, our district attorney has a pattern of omitting facts, cherry-picking facts, and speculating when there are no facts. And that's been revealed by Dave Waddell, who's doing a book on policing in Butte County. There are 36 civilians. I don't know if that counts, Tyler, or not, but 36 or 37 who've been killed by law enforcement in Butte County since D.A. Ramsey has been the district attorney. I know you want to talk about him, but let's first learn about who was Tyler Rushing, your son, and why was he in Chico in July of 2017?
Tyler had been working at a music festival up near Garberville, and some of the members of the staff were from Chico, and he had friends from Chico, and he had some trouble with his work truck. To make a long story short, he called us and asked my wife and I to help him get his truck repaired into a dealership, and we agreed to do that, and that was just a couple of days before he was killed, and he went to Chico to be with some friends, and, you know, he's 34, Chris, he's not a child, and he had been working festivals for a while. He was on the workup crew, might be anything from traffic to stage lighting, anything, fencing. He helped the venue organize, and he really enjoyed that, and he was working into being a professional photographer. He had a mentor. He had a online business called Tiger Eye Photography, taking behind-the-scenes pictures of bands and artists, and then he was selling them over the internet with the approval of these professionals. And so he was an entrepreneur. He had a home in Ventura, a condo, and in between these festivals, he had a window cleaning business called Clear Perfection. And Mr. Ramsey tried to imply that he was just a window washer, but this was a commercial and residential route, and he had a lot of senior citizens. And he also worked for me. I'm a property manager, and when I could get him, he was so busy, to do windows and screens. And he was pretty famous for doing ladder work, Chris. And, you know, seniors don't want to get on ladders. So when Tyler would go to an elderly person's home, he'd get on the ladder, he'd pull a newspaper off a roof, or, you know, he would take a Frisbee off the roof or whatever, because he wouldn't let seniors get on ladders. And the people just loved him. And, you know, he did that for about 10 years after he graduated from Catholic high school. He wasn't really college material. He liked to do things. And then he got interested in photography and these festivals, and he used his skills that way. And he ended up in Chico because he had friends there. And last time I talked to him, which was Saturday morning, the day before he was killed, to let him know we're on our way up to Garberville to get his truck and help him out. And then we would get over to Chico Saturday, Sunday, and get him and come on back to Ventura. The last I talked to him, he told me that he had met some unhoused people, and he was surprised at how hard the people were in Chico, business people, police, to the unhoused. And he had met some people, he'd befriended some people, he'd got some shoes for a pair of shoes for a man who had no shoes, who was unhoused, and he'd got those at the Discovery Shop, so he's familiar with that. And my wife was a Chico State graduate. Tyler's aunt, Paula's sister, was a Chico State graduate. And our memory, and my parents used to live in Paradise, so our memory of Chico from the 70s was a very bucolic and peaceful town. And we just thought he'd be safe with friends for the few days while we helped him get his truck repaired and get him and get back on the road. Little did we know how dangerous it was for him to be helping homeless people. And frankly, I think he was profiled as a homeless, transient, disposable person the evening he was killed.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. It seems that from what the security guard's boss said, which of course you can tell us, but tell right. us about what happened with that security guard, where he was, and I know this is difficult for you. It was difficult for me. I feel like there's a part of me that's always going to be standing at the bathroom door, seeing that the grisly footage from now on. But let's talk about the night he died and what happened.
Well, the facts that we know, and again, as a plaintiff in this case, trying to get a trial for Tyler, we only know the facts that the DA releases to us. And the images that you saw and that I have seen and my legal team has seen have all been edited and clipped by the district attorney. Mm-hmm. And he admitted it. I had a number of meetings with him. They were taped, recorded. I had them transcribed. And he admitted that what we see has been edited and clipped by his people. So, we have the defendants giving us our evidence as the plaintiffs. So it's already tainted what's been given to us. But in spite of that, as you could tell, you could get a sense of the violence and of the quickness and speed with which Tyler was killed. The guard responded to an alarm there, which is his job. Eagle Security called Armed Guard Private Protection, and they sent out Edgar Sanchez, the guard, 23-year-old armed guard, to investigate the alarm. And the alarm was also a toned alarm. It was a loud blast, which you probably didn't hear in the body-worn cameras, but it's so loud in the building, you can't even talk. Mr. Ramsey is trying to convince me that Tyler was in the building moving out office supplies, copier, paper, staplers, things that he might possibly sell. We don't really know if he was even in the building. But nevertheless, supposedly for about 8 minutes, Tyler was in the building removing things after he broke into the patio to do something, sell it, give it away. He took some juice out of the break room refrigerator. But for example, he left money in the drawers. There was cash in the drawers. There was no cash taken. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. And the guard arrived. He pulled his gun out, which is a violation of state law and guidelines. And he used the tactical flashlight on his pistol. It's a Glock 17, the semi-automatic pistol. Here's a 23-year-old coming through the bushes in the dark through a chain link fence, unannounced. He was dressed in black. He had his gun out, pointed, because he was using the flashlight on the tactical light. And I say that Tyler was scared. I will never really know, because Tyler was the only civilian witness, and of course he was killed. So I think Tyler tried to knock the gun out of Sanchez's hands, because Sanchez made no announcement. Tyler had no idea who was pointing a gun at him. But he was unsuccessful. Tyler did try to use a small flower vase to kind of help knock the gun out. He hit Sanchez on the left wrist, but unfortunately Sanchez had his gun in his right hand, and he shot Tyler just an inch or two away from his chest with a hollow point mushrooming bullet, and it just tore up the inside of Tyler's chest, his ribs. It bounced around, pierced his lung, did some what Ramsey called a sucking chest wound, and then Tyler ran off in this little patio, if you've seen it, and when he did go into the building, Sanchez fired a number of rounds. There's an argument over that, and then he continued to hunt with his gun out there, which you can see, and that is totally against the state laws for guards. Chris, they're obligated to observe and report. So once Sanchez got to the building, he wasn't even supposed to unholster his gun. He's supposed to inspect the building. If he suspects a break-in, he's supposed to call the police. Stay safe, stay out of, you know, harm's way, stay away from confrontation, and call a professional.
Yes.
He did the opposite. He pulled his gun out and he went hunting for a burglar.
Right.
And that started the chain of events that led to Tyler's death.
Right. I wanted to announce you again. I'm speaking with Scott Rushing. He's the father of Tyler Rushing, who was killed by Chico Police Department on July 23rd, 2017. This is the first part of this horrible saga. So I'm going to let you go ahead, Mr. Rushing, and tell our listeners the rest of it, please.
Yeah, please call me Scott. And also, so then Tyler did go into the building. He went into the bathroom. And he gave himself some first aid. He wrapped a trash can liner around his chest and used a tampon. And he used part of a picture, I don't know, some kind of a picture there, the frame of a picture that was in the bathroom, small lady's bathroom, wrapped it around his chest, and that stopped the blood loss. It's called a hemopneumothorax, and that allowed him to survive. And then the SWAT team came, Sergeant Ruffel and his crew came, went inside the building, discovered Tyler was in the bathroom. Tyler did say, "I have a gun." And Mr. Ruffel, Sergeant Ruffel said, "Oh, we have guns too." So that was not a very reassuring comment, you know, back to Tyler, who was bleeding out in the bathroom. And for about 30 minutes, Ruffel, instead of calling a crisis negotiation team, getting more professional people in there that deal with wounded, barricaded suspects. Ruffel called for the canine. A deputy sheriff showed up, Ian Dickerson, and as you can see in the tape, they devised a break-in plan on a medical rescue, and they broke in and they sicked the dog on him. And the dog got off the lead. Dickerson let the dog go, and they pulled Tyler from behind the door, and the dog was biting. According to Dickerson, was biting Tyler from ankle to armpit, and he had the dog, this is a Belgian Malinois, very powerful dog, had off-leash, had his snout between Tyler's legs. And I'll just let you listeners consider that. And so Tyler did resist. He did thrash around. And he might have hit Ruffel in the neck with a Chico PD ballpoint pen that somehow Tyler got a hold of. Why would you go into an extraction with a ballpoint pen in your shirt pocket? Makes no sense to me. But nevertheless, Sergeant Ruffel was choking Tyler. I believe he lost his cool when Tyler was resisting, and Sergeant Ruffel pulled out his pistol. He fired a gun right into Tyler's trachea, and that exited the back of Tyler's neck. And then as Tyler was either falling down or even possibly on the floor, it's not seen in the video, Tyler got a second shot about 2 inches away in the back of his head. And then when he was laying down in a pool of blood, he got tasered by Officer Alex Fleer with Chico PD, and that's called giving a ride. He got a ride, a 50,000-volt ride, while he was clinging to life. And then they dragged him out and, you know, tried to give him. The medics were there, and they tried to save him, but he was too far gone, and his body laid there for about 6 hours, 6 to 8 hours there in a bag or covered, we're not sure, before the DOJ could come and take their pictures. So it's a pretty horrible ending. If you think the panic, the fear, he was alone, he was in a bathroom, he was in a threat to nobody except himself. He was totally confined. This was a medical rescue, Chris. They knew he had been shot because the blood was coming from underneath the door. So instead of, you know, just waiting till it was safe, till it was super quiet, they broke in. They accelerated and rushed that extraction. And Tyler was very alive, Chris, when he went into that bathroom. He was wounded, but very alive, and they dragged him out very dead. And this was just seconds. It took about 40 seconds from the time Ruppel broke in to the time Ruppel shot him through the throat. Only about 40 seconds. So I'm very critical of the tactics of the use of force and the ethical, the ethical way that this group responded, whether it was the guard, the police, the sheriff, on a medical rescue on a suspect. You know, Tyler wasn't convicted of anything. He was just a suspect at that point.
Right.
And nevertheless, I lost my son, and nothing will bring him back.
No. And I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. I give my condolences to both you and your wife. I'm sorry. There is so much in the following years that happened in terms of your wrongful death suit and the failure of the DA to release information to you, even the discovery process, that would have changed the judge's ruling, no doubt. Do you want to tell us next, Scott Rushing, about the legal suit? And I want to let our listeners know this is KZFR Community Radio. Go ahead, Scott.
Yes, my frustration with the district attorney and your legal counsel, Brad Stevens, at the County of Butte, I think that's his name, to be honest with you, and your city attorney, Vince Ewing, and Chico, this information was available, these video recordings of the officers who were involved in killing Tyler. They were just done hours after he was killed, which would have been July 24th, 2017. We just got those a few weeks ago in June, my legal team, my attorneys, myself. And, 4 years later, we get this crucial evidence released to us. And it definitely obstructed and diminished our legal, my case, because the actual officer in charge, Chris, was the deputy sheriff with the dog. He took control because he was a canine handler. We didn't even know he was in charge. Mr. Ramsey downplayed that coordination, which was done by Ingrid Dickerson, who's a very new officer. He'd only been with the dog about a year. Ramsey led us to believe Sergeant Ruppel was the one that designed the entire action of extracting Tyler on a medical rescue. But it turns out it was actually Ian Dickerson, and we didn't even know that until a few weeks ago. So we were not even able to depose Dickerson during our discovery phase, which is back in 2019 when all the depositions were being done. There were about a dozen depositions of different people done. We didn't even depose the actual officer in charge. So that was kept from us. We just found that out a few days ago. So yes, I don't know about the legalities of that situation, but we are researching it. But I know it's certainly unethical not to release the evidence you had. And they had that the day after Tyler was killed, Chris, and we just got it a few weeks ago. So yes, I'm highly critical. It's a fact. It's not my opinion of how that evidence was suppressed and withheld.
And you're appealing, is that correct?
Yes.
And so that's going to be coming up October 5th, I believe. And
October 5th.
And you'll be before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco with this new information. And so Butte County is going to be on the hot seat. What are you hoping to have happen?
Well, here's the sad thing. Let me just correct you and listeners a little bit. The ability to make our brief and our documents to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal ended weeks ago, actually in March. So this new evidence, we are actually not allowed to take into the appeal. We're not allowed to reintroduce evidence at the 11th hour. It's a civil procedure. So, maybe it was a mistake by Mr. Ramsey, maybe it was an accident by Mr. Ramsey, but nevertheless, we didn't get the material until beyond the deadline to supply our brief. So we feel very wrong, obviously, my group and I, my wife and I, very wronged by this. But for the appeal, we've already submitted all our paperwork, and we cannot add any more. That will be held October 9th in San Francisco, be a virtual hearing because of COVID and security reasons. So my attorney will be actually making his appeal on my behalf to reverse the lower court decision. This Judge England, who your listeners have now heard the name of Judge England, Morrison C. England, he's involved in the homeless case that against City of Chico and the homeless people, Warren versus City of Chico. That's the same judge who's hearing my case, the Rushing versus the City of Chico. And Judge England dismissed my case July of 2020. He dismissed my case in the 9th District Federal Court of Appeals, and then we appealed immediately to the 9th Circuit Court of Appeals. A little bit confusing, mm-hmm. but that's the civil procedure, and I hired appellate attorneys, and they will be making a presentation to a 3-judge panel, Chris, and that 3-judge panel will decide to reverse Judge England or not. So it's a very important day for me. And we did the best we can with the information that we had in our appeal document. But as we've discovered, our appeal has been tainted because of lack of evidence.
Scott Rushing, sorry for that interruption. I don't know if it went out over the air, but there was a EAS, and I didn't know quite what to do with it. But anyway, it turned off, so there's no emergency. That was all a little confusing, but I am glad that you got to state it, because I think it's important for people to realize how convoluted these cases get when you seek justice through the legal system. There have been so many details of this that you have been able to dig up and to present that I wish that there was a way for people to, like, in a nutshell, get all of this information that you got to me, like the misuse of the canine. When I viewed the footage, this barking, frenzied dog just added to the bedlam, and the just, you know, people should think when they act, especially when using deadly force. And this dog, it was just created such an environment of craziness. And so even that, I think you deserve to be able to, you know, to have changes in the City of Chico just over that one issue. And yet there's so many issues, like releasing information, you know, and there's laws where this information should have been released to you, and yet it wasn't. So I'd like to continue this in the next segment. Are you good with me, Scott Rushing, staying with me for a moment, please?
Yeah, I'll be here.
All right. Well, so think about what you'd like to say about that. And listeners, I'm going to keep Scott Rushing with us for another few minutes so that we can talk about some more of the general issues about policing in Chico, because it's too important. He has learned the very hardest way about policing in our community, and we need his guidance and expertise going forward in order to do the reforms that are necessary. In the meantime, I want to thank all of you who support Community Radio, and the only place you're going to be able to hear programs like this with guests that are able to, in long form, tell us about their situations that apply to all of us. So thank you, listeners. But I also like to thank our underwriters. I'd like to thank Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And Chico Performances, which is presenting 7 Things I've Learned with Ira Glass, host and creator of This American Life, on Saturday, September 25th at Laxon Auditorium. Ira Glass and This American Life have won the highest honors for broadcasting and journalistic excellence, including 7 Peabody Awards and the first Pulitzer Prize ever awarded for audio journalism. Tickets at the University Box Office, 898-6333, or at chicoperformances.com. It is just now noon. This is FM 90.1 KZFR. Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters. They are mine and my guests only. I'd like to thank some more underwriters before we go on with the interview with Scott Rushing. I'd like to thank the supporters of the 2021 Salmon Kayak Float, which will return on Saturday, September 25th on the Feather River during the annual Chinook Salmon Migration. There are two floats at 9:30 and 12:30 from under the Green Bridge at the Hatchery in Oroville. Plus, there's a shuttle back to your car. Details and tickets on Facebook at Four Bay Aquatic Center and at fourbayaquaticcenter.com. And Drunken Dumpling. It's a dine-in restaurant serving locally sourced, fresh, handmade Asian fusion comfort food at 1414 Park Avenue, Suite 120, just behind Nobby's. Open 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. The details are on Facebook, Instagram, and at drunkendumplingchico.com. Drunken Dumpling, where they love food, flavor, and our community. So, our community is what I wanted to ask you about, but I think I need to let you first respond to what we were talking about before the break, Scott Rushing, in regards to the death of your son at the hands of Chico Police Department. What would you like to add about how the case was handled?
Well, first thing I would like to piggyback on something you said earlier is to recognize Dave Waddell and the work that he has done researching not only Tyler's killing, but the other 36. There's actually been 37 civilians killed with the recent killing of Stephen Vest last year. That was the 37th killing of a civilian during the tenure of D.A. Ramsey. And for a small county like Butte, that's a very high number of civilians killed and officer-involved killings. And Dave has a calling. He's Dave Waddell and Leslie Layton at ChicoSoul.org, you know, have put a lot of work into it. Not really me. I was blown off by the city, by the county, and my attorney was when we, you know, requested the evidence through the normal discovery process. We were just blown off. Mm. And through Dave's effort, and Dave got an attorney, but through his effort, he's been able to dig out and pry away from the city and the county, this extra material, not only on Tyler, but on Desmond and Brianne and Stephen Vest, where he's still waiting for some material on Tyler's killing, Stephen Vest. They were the last two victims of officer-involved shootings. So I would encourage everyone, give your listeners, if they are of a mind, to get up to speed on what's happening with officer-involved shootings under the tenure of Ramsey, to read these three articles. Davis on ChicoSoul.org has two of them already that he's published. I know he's working on a third in the series. Yeah. Trying to wrap it up on these killings. And they're long, and they're, as you figured out, the civil procedure and the details get into the weeds about what you can and cannot do, what has and hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. But the overarching concern that I have is just the trigger-happy culture of Butte County Sheriffs and Chico PD, and even issues of racism that bother me. You know, the Michael Sears case. I mean, we're a white family, and we have the resources to push back. I'm the guy to push back because I have the money and the ability to push back against these law enforcement agencies. But the majority of the dead were mentally ill. They're from poor families. They can't do that. And Ramsey knows that. He knows that he's not going to get much pushback from these people. So it's easier for him to exonerate the officers.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have that with me. And I think that's why he met with me so much. I feel he's trying to convince my wife and I that Tyler was solely responsible for Tyler's death. And I didn't buy that. I told him to his face. I thought his story didn't pass the smell test. He got red as a beet, and he got his nose right in my face. So that was our first meeting, and nothing has really been good since then. But I did stay in somewhat communication through September of 2017, and then we cut off after he issued his report, you know, exonerating all the officers involved. After initially implying that he was going to get to the truth of this, Chris, you know, I'm going to get to the bottom of this, and if these guys use excessive force, that won't stop me from, you know, prosecuting them. So he sort of leads the families on, and then, you know, the truth comes out later on, which is pretty offensive to me. You know, he might as well be honest with the people, the families, and tell them their challenges right up front. I wouldn't obfuscate and mislead. But that's my impression of how he treated us, my wife and I.
You know,
so that would be my summary.
Right, and I'm hearing you. I know that's how he acts. I spoke to him a lot after Feaster shot someone in cold blood.
Andrew Thomas. Yeah.
Andrew Thomas, thank you for his name. Scott Rushing, I wanted to just let our listeners know while it's on my mind that Dave Waddell has the third in the three-part series coming out in Chico Soul next week. So listeners, please be aware of that and read it. We have no civilian oversight of law enforcement in the county or in Chico, and yet police use up over 50% of our budget. So it's really important for us to listen to your leadership on this. And we have 4 minutes left, and I want you to go ahead and make your ask. What do you want from the people?
Well, thank you, Chris. Yes, I'm glad you reminded me. My wrap-up on this, everyone, is your listeners, is to write letters, to press your politicians to change the culture of the police, law enforcement agencies in your county. You know, they really are sworn to protect and serve, you know, and yet they're trained to point and shoot. And that is not what law enforcement is about. It's about communication. It's about listening. And that's just simply not happening, in my opinion, in your area. They've got lots of new toys, dogs, drones, but they're making no effort to get less lethal devices. And you might have seen that I've been writing about that. There's many choices. Getting back to Tyler, when they broke into the bathroom, they didn't have to shoot him. Idari was wounded. They could have used pepper spray, a baton, the taser. You know, they had so many non-lethal options. He was in a bathroom. He had no place to go, and he was bleeding to death. But he gets a bullet in the throat and the back of the head. That's not exactly a peace officer, role model, in my opinion, and totally unnecessary use of force. So write your politicians, write your council members. You need to change the culture of law enforcement in Butte County. You, the people, I live in Ventura. There's not much I can do. I'm doing what I can do. But I'm calling you out, everybody who's listening to Chris's show. Get to work. Write. Go to those meetings. Act up. You've got to change the culture of law enforcement in your community.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I wanted to get your response to the fact that former Chief O'Brien, suddenly ended up on our city council. And after a illusory nationwide search for a new police chief, we ended up with his former deputy chief becoming the police chief, ostensibly still under O'Brien's control. I don't know, but there's such a conflict there. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's a total conflict of interest. I've written about it. Mr. Ramsey, you know, makes a call to Mike O'Brien. And, of course, I caught Ramsey and O'Brien in a little misstatement. I won't say it's a lie, but it was certainly a misstatement. You know, Mr. Ramsey wrote a letter to the Chico Enterprise Record saying he did not ask O'Brien to run for city council, and yet O'Brien, in his July 20th presentation to the city council, that's the first thing he said.
Nice.
I just got a call from District Attorney Mike Ramsey, and he told me to run, and boom. So here's a direct conflict between the two top cops in, you know, your county, you know, former chief, DA, and they're misleading the public. Somebody's not telling the truth. And I called him out on that. Dave Waddell has tried to get a response. The response we get, I don't try because they just blow me off. But Dave has tried, and he gets a no-comment response. That's the response you get from the top law enforcement official. And the farce of that national search for the top cop to replace, you know, O'Brien turned out to be the deputy chief. Wow, you know, what a shock that the top cop in the country was the number two guy at Chico PD. What a shock. I mean, how insulting is that to your listeners? It was just my opinion, but a total farce. And I'm sure everybody moved up the ladder when, you know, Mike O'Brien retired, and then Ramsey makes sure, and that's been proven by O'Brien's own comments, that he got placed above all the other candidates on the council, which just increased Mr. Ramsey's control. And that's what I wrote about. And I proved Mr. Ramsey wrong in his own words. So there's evidence there for you people, you Chicoans and people of Butte County, to act and push back, unless you want a police state. If you want that, you got it. But
right.
If you want civil rights, if you want a nice college town, the way I remember it from the 70s when my mom and dad lived in Paradise, then you're going to have to make it happen. You're going to have to push back.
Well, thank you, Scott Rushing. I really appreciate you being my guest today on the Peace and Justice program. Again, I think all of us listening are so sorry for the loss of your child, and we are going to be following you, and I hope that that you have success, and I hope that everybody does who's listening do everything they can in order to end this impunity, get rid of this DA, and change this culture, the way that policing takes place in our community and around the country. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Chris.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. So you're listening to the Peace and Justice program here on your community radio station, KZFR. I'm going to put on a, what's his name? Sorry, my brain, Bobby McFerrin from Medicine Music, and I just thought that this is something that he wrote, that he adapted after his mom. Sorry.
Is my shepherd, I have all I need. She makes me lie down in green meadows. Beside the still waters she will lead. She restores my soul, she rights my wrongs. She leads me in a path of good things and fills my heart with songs. Even though I walk through a dark and dreary land, there is nothing that can shake me. She has said she won't forsake me, I'm in her hand. She sets a table before me in the presence of my foes.
All right, I thought that was mournful, but also prayerful. And not much you can say or do when somebody is gone. And so anyway, our love goes out to all those who have lost a loved one. And I have on the line with me Jessica Gianola. Jessica Gianola is a Chico State graduate in public health education and current housing case manager and advocate for health and services for our unhoused population. She has boots-on-the-ground experience working with a number of area nonprofit organizations that work directly with our growing numbers of unhoused residents and knows many of their stories well. She regularly attends city council meetings where she frequently speaks to the council members on current issues impacting our community and uses her voice for awareness and accurate information.
Jessica, I hope, is on the line with me, but you also can hear Jessica from Wednesday night's The Real Issue with Sue Hildebrand, and that is archived on the KZFR website. Sue was able to give Jessica more time than we have today. Jessica, I wanted you to tell us, actually read to us from your letter to the editor, your most recent one, because I think it really is important for people to hear that.
Let me pull it up here just so I can read that.
And thank you for being with us today on the Peace and Justice Show. I know it's hard to follow up after Scott Rushing. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm sorry. I didn't know I was going to actually read it, so I have to pull it up.
Okay.
It'll take me a second here.
Okay. All right, I'll give you a moment to do that. And, you know, we had a death at Tigard Ponds that I wanted to talk to Jessica about, too. One of the people who lives at Tigard said that the police seemed to be sure there that no tangible evidence could be presented. They didn't take pictures, didn't secure the crime scene in any way, didn't take pictures of the casings when they removed what they thought was all of them, pulled the pants off one of the men and left him exposed in the dirt, roughly rolled our friend that died over to see the slug in his back, and then hastily almost dropped him back on his back in the dirt. I could see him breathing when they started to roll him, but not after they rolled him back over. Why were the police touching those men at all? They were not trying to administer life-saving services. They were just manhandling them.
Yeah.
So...
I have it here.
Okay. Go ahead, Jessica.
I wrote to the Tigard ER. I wrote recently over 20 names of unhoused residents that died in the past 18 months were read during public speaking at a council meeting. This brought tears to many of us listening. As the speaker walked away from the podium, the mayor, without an ounce of recognition or awareness, said, "All right, moving on to item 4.1. This same disconnected response remains consistent from council majority as emotional citizens beg for water access to unhoused folks, for living and accessible spaces, for shelter resolutions, and for basic compassion from the city. All are met without acknowledgement, and later often in mockery on social media. The mayor stated that we are asking for the moon when asking for the most basic of services and needs being met. Councilman Morgan claims that we want a Ferris wheel, the majority referring to our asks as unreasonable, and they place blame on the judge for protecting federal rights, refusing to own the wrongs of the city. They irresponsibly resist working with known local providers and advocates due to personal and political preference, fostering constant mistrust of their experiences and advocacy. They hypocritically discount partnerships and funding to established local nonprofits that provide critical and diverse services, like Caring Choices, in favor of Hope Street or Point of Contact, who have consistently raised concerns over unethical practices and lack of proven experience. This is done so seemingly out of spite, as the city continues to wage war against those impoverished and to those who step up to help them." So that was my letter that I had sent in.
Yeah, so Jessica, since you submitted that article and it was published, quite a bit has happened. Do you want to talk about the two councilmen who were on KPAY radio, one of which was Andrew Coolidge, who said that defendants in the suit that's allowing people to stay in place holds the city hostage, letting unhoused do anything they want. We are over our barrel. What are your thoughts about what you've been hearing lately from the city council?
Yes, and that was Sean Morgan's interview where he had made those statements, those horrendous statements. I had written this letter right before we had two more people assaulted, one murdered out at Tigard Ponds. And so immediately following this statement, another death occurs. And so when I heard Sean Morgan's interview and then followed by Mayor Coolidge, and they're again repeating this rhetoric that what's being asked for is unreasonable. And what's being asked for is just basics. One, just respect as another human being, but basic services to help them get on their feet and to get into housing. And the mockery that they do continue by using terms like, we want a Ferris wheel, or we want a Holiday Inn, or we're reaching for the moon. And it's just such a disconnect from our leadership to what our needs are that are necessary for people to survive and to get out of the place they're in. It just baffles me. It makes me so sad. It's so frustrating, especially as being one of the advocates that's out there working hard to try and help people reach what little services are available.
Yeah.
And to be painted as a target as well, because one of the statements that Councilman Morgan had made was, if you're going to be angry, be angry with the people who are supporting them.
Yeah. Well,
that would be the advocates out there and the service providers.
Right.
Having people angry at us is not going to help anything.
Maybe it would help our listeners to know the kind of services that you've been providing. I know for me, it's just been sandwiches and snacks and fluids. I mean, I've been just very, very basic with my interaction with the unhoused. But what do you do?
Well, I was working with case management. You want to have you want people to be able to obtain services. So, for a lot of services, people need to have an ID. And many people out in the encampment, if they had an ID before, it's probably been stolen at this point. They need to replace it. And to have an ID sent to you, you need to have an address. And many people out there, they don't have an address, even a safe mailing address.
Mm.
So they're having to use services like the post office, or general delivery. The mail doesn't always come to them. And so there's a struggle in just obtaining an ID. And then having the money to get the ID or the transportation to get to DMV to get the ID.
Right.
All of those are barriers. And so I would help different clients trying to just get the ID. Even staying in a hotel just for a night was impossible if the person did not have an ID.
Mm.
So that's one thing I would help people with accessing, is trying to get just the basic of identification that can help lead them to other services. They're prevented until that point even comes. And so that's just one thing. Trying to get on housing lists. A lot of our services are pulled from Butte 211. They call 211, and their people are enrolled into this coordinated entry program. And that's where most of our services, our service providers, can pull from. They pull their names from there to help them connect to services. But a person has to have a phone to make that call. There's no online option for this registry. There's no in-person option. It has to be by phone, and it's not done immediately. The person calls, and if they have a phone, they can use their phone. But if they're borrowing a phone, they have to call and make an appointment, and the appointment can be days or the next week. So then they have to, and it's a callback, so then they have to give a number that they can get a call back and be waiting by the phone so they can do that process. And I have sat with people out under trees in 110 temperature and not get that call back.
Mm.
And then we had to try and figure out what happened. And then there was someone didn't show up, and we had to set another appointment just to simply get into the system.
Right.
So we find all these barriers that people who are unhoused and they don't have a way of charging a phone, or their phone gets stolen, And they have all these things that just keep hitting them time and time again. It's making their, just to get housing and assistance, nearly impossible.
Right.
It's not a lack of trying. It's a lack of ability.
Right.
It's really difficult.
So I don't want to run out of time with you, Jessica Gianola. Today was the day that the city decided that the airport site was going to close. There are a number of RVs out there, a lot of people with expired tags and no way to
yeah.
get gas. And what are you advising?
Well, if I could advise the city really, they need to lessen the focus on the lawsuit and what is behind the lawsuit. The lawsuit is that people's basic rights are being violated, being pushed around, and property taken from them, really out of no choice of their own at this point, with lack of other options. And so some people have vehicles, some have tags expired, and they don't have any other place to stay, and that is their home. So they do need a safe parking spot. And the airport site, it was completely inaccessible to someone who did not have a vehicle, but it did seem to work well temporarily for a safe parking space. So if the city is abandoning that site, where else can people go with these vehicles so they can stay while the city and the county and the state, while we all work together and trying to figure out other more appropriate sheltering spaces? So we do need to have safe space available for people to park the vehicles at Comanche. That's where a lot of our in-house have ended up. There was a rash of tows recently because of the same thing. They didn't have current tags. So those vehicles were towed away, but that was someone's house. That was their home and their belongings. So we do need to do something at the city as far as an allotted, safe, recognized space that people can be without having their possessions taken from them.
And some people are suggesting the park and ride for the time being in between 8th and 9th.
That's a great idea.
So the last thing is, we're already out of time, unfortunately, but today I read that Rob Berry, who is on the wrong side of this issue, unfortunately, filed a cease and desist because of all the items that haven't been published on the agenda, unlawfully, I had it on my phone. But anyway, multiple violations of the Brown Act. And just wanted to see if, for the last thing, if you wanted to comment on that, since it's the most recent part of this saga.
Yeah, I had mixed feelings when I seen that Rob Berry had filed this against the city. On one hand, it would be nice that we all be involved with this process. I know there's litigation going on, but the mayor did reach out to the community and ask for our opinion and our advice as professionals and people who know what we're talking about. We know the needs and the circumstances of people out in the encampments and without homes. So we were part of that process, but then that ended. And the city, the people of the city have been excluded since then. So on one hand, I could say, it would be nice if we knew more information. On another hand, I have to worry, is this maybe in defense of Morgan speaking when he shouldn't have, Councilman Morgan, mm-hmm. When he gave too much information, is this the sort of preemptive defense that he should have been okay to do it? So I don't know. I do worry sometimes about what's the motive behind it. I fear it will, it could potentially hold up getting answers and finally acting on a safe space for people and actual shelter development. I hope that doesn't delay that process.
Right.
But it is interesting how we have city people active in the city and in wanting to know what's going on, and if they have the power of a degree behind them, then they may ask for their involvement too. So.
Well, thank you, Jessica Gianola, for everything you're doing, and we really appreciate you being on the Peace and Justice Show today. Stay strong.
Thank you. You too, and I appreciate your help out there too. Everybody does.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go on to our next guest, and we are going to have some positive information about homelessness and how we, as a community, can respond by using the example of a successful community in Olympia, Washington. Here's a little Bruce Springsteen.
The Lord is my shepherd.
No. Sorry. Hang on.
Men walking along the railroad tracks, going someplace and there's no going back. Highway patrol choppers coming up over reach. Hot soup on a campfire in the bridge. Shelter line stretching round the corner. Welcome to the new world home. Sleeping in the car in the southwest. No home, no job, no peace, no rest. Well, I
highway is alive tonight. Nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire light, searching for the ghost of Tom Joe. He pulls a prayer book out of his sleeping bag. Preacher lights up a butt and takes a drag, waiting for when the last shall be first and the first shall be last. Cardboard box near the underpass, got a one-way ticket to the promised land. You got a hole in your belly and a gun in your hand, sleeping on a pillow of solid rock, bathing in the city aqueduct. The highway is alive tonight. Where it's headed, everybody knows. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line, waiting on the ghost.
All right, Tom Joad. That was during the Dust Bowl days, and people were referred to as transients, people who were on the move. And with the eviction crisis that we're going to be facing at the end of the month, who knows if that will happen again. But what's important is that we meet the crisis head on. And I have on the line with me Meg Martin. She is a MSW. She's the executive director for the Interfaith Works Overnight Shelter in Olympia, Washington. Welcome, Meg.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You know, you are one of my heroes here because I've been reading about what you do, and I know that you are able to answer questions about homelessness because you've been in this work for a very long time. And when somebody says anything about, I mean, put people down for being transients or any of the other scapegoating things that are said sometimes about the unhoused, how do you respond?
Well, I think that I respond in a few different ways. Something that I've learned over the years doing this work and just hearing the concerns from every different angle, whether it's from somebody who's experiencing homelessness themselves and sleeping on the sidewalk every night to somebody who, would never be close to that reality, because their safety net is so abundant in their lives. And so the first step is that I meet people exactly where they're at, regardless of their circumstances. And what that means is that when we are working with folks who are on the street, we meet them exactly where they're at and do what we can to get their basic physical and emotional needs met in the moment to the best of our ability. So when I hear that language, I really just kind of assess, who am I talking to? What are they dealing with? What is the basic emotional need that they have in this moment? Is it that they're scared? Is it that they're angry? What might it be? And that's the first step. See where they're at and what it is that they need. And then I try to just illustrate that whenever we dehumanize each other, whatever the issue might be, it gets us further and further away from a place of solutions. And what I have found, whether you are the fiercest advocate, activist for people who are sleeping on the streets, or you're somebody who dehumanizes them on a regular basis because you are disgusted by it, typically we want the same thing, which is to get folks off the street, to eradicate homelessness in our communities. And so if we can start from that shared place, we can at least agree that that's where we need to begin, that we both want the same thing, and then go from there.
Excellent. So I'd like you to tell our listeners about the work of Interfaith Works Emergency Overnight Shelter, because your history is really important. We need to learn how to get from where we are to where you are. Thanks.
Yeah, so we started with a lot of political division in our community. There was really a lot of fear from all sides, fear of people who are going to become homeless or who already were homeless, and the real life and death scenarios and situations that were playing out on our streets every day. And then fear from a community that didn't, you know, couldn't imagine what it would be like to have more services in our town, or really were afraid that if we had more services in our town, it would attract more people who were struggling to our town. Our small businesses were suffering, and already we hadn't had a lot of new development in our community in a long time. And so there was all of this sort of, if we, you know, the myth of if you build it, they will come. And I can talk a little bit more about why that's a myth. But so we had to really utilize that skill set of just, how do we meet people exactly where they're at, regardless of their circumstances, whether they're rich or they're poor, and have real conversations about the shared values? Because, again, that's the place where ideas are born from. And we had to really listen to a lot of voices that were different than ours, that were coming from really different perspectives than ours, and try to compromise and work together in a way that didn't end up leaving people out, that continued to create a system in which everyone was welcome to access those services. Because a lot of times what communities will do is try to put up a lot of, you know, people need to get sober or go to jail, get sober or go to shelter. People need to take their mental health medication or be, you know, institutionalized, right? There's, because we feel so out of control as a community of the situation, we want to try to get control no matter what we can. And what we did was that we just tried to really bring our community through a process of understanding that the more you try to control an individual's life, the less likely they are to get to the shared goal that you want at the end, which is for them to be off the streets, be more connected to services, be able to manage their physical, mental health, and substance use related challenges. So I just, you know, we really saw how making sure that we had conversations in a way that didn't isolate some parts of our homeless population, and isolate them away from the opportunity to better their lives, we saw the whole homeless system strengthen and be able to reach people who had historically been completely left out.
Hmm. Boy, that is excellent. I have ideas to speak with you more in the future, but right now I just want to tell our listeners this is a Peace and Justice program. My name is Chris, and I'm speaking to Meg Martin from Olympia, Washington. She is she's the director of the Interfaith Works Emergency Overnight Shelter, where they have actually two 24/7 shelter locations. Following this show, we'll be playing Dead at 1 o'clock. Meg, I want to ask you now about the shelter locations. How did you get there? You know, how did you fund those, and what do they do, and everything you can about what you have going in Olympia?
Yeah, so we originally started, well, the organization that we're under, Interfaith Works, that I'm the executive director for, was sort of a synchronistic meeting. And another kind of key to our success in the community is that we early on decided that it was really important that we needed to make unlikely partnerships. And so the way that our shelter program started was through some really intense advocacy of myself and two other outreach workers in about 2012 in response to our city passing a series of, you know, what are called quality of life ordinances. It was aggressive panhandling, no camping on public property, and a sidewalk sit-lie ordinance that restricted the times that people could sit or lie down on the pavement. And We were responding to that by advocating at City Hall that if people weren't allowed to be in certain places, we believed that it was the government's responsibility to provide a place for them to be, particularly for people who are elders in our community, who are permanently disabled and living with significant challenges. And so that sort of is what started it. And the city kind of responded to us that if we wanted to be successful in that, we needed to partner with a more established organization. So we came under the umbrella of Interfaith Works at that time, who had had a really long history. And I believe there's some shared history in the Chico area of faith communities that have hosted volunteer-based shelters over the years. In our community, that looked like rotating every 2 weeks from church to church during the winter months. And Interfaith Works was sort of the convener and the coordinator and the support organization for that. So we sort of melded worlds and took that volunteer-based model that had been happening for 25 years and then professionalized it. And we wrote a grant to the county. So our money comes, about 60% of our money is public funds from federal, state, and county sources. And so we wrote a grant to open our community's first high-access shelter. And what that meant was that we would have 30 beds at the beginning that were just nighttime only, that were associated with specific individuals that we had identified as the most likely to die if they were left out on the streets. So when we opened, those 30 beds had 30 names attached to it. They also happened to be the same 30 people who were having the highest interactions with emergency services because they were the most disconnected from the social service network. So they were very high utilizers of the emergency department and daily interactions at times with law enforcement for non-criminal reasons. And so we opened November 1st, and after a very long, very public, drawn-out fight, for lack of a better term, of where to put the shelter in our community. It was about 18 months of trying to find a location, and we eventually were able to open in the basement of a church of one of the members of Interfaith Works, First Christian Church. And so that was 2014 with 12 employees and a $200,000 budget. And now fast forward through COVID, and we operate now two 24-hour shelters, and we have a nine-person case management team that's all peer support. So that means people with lived experience with either housing instability, mental health challenges, or substance use challenges get trained to be case managers for folks. And we also are building two development projects right now. One of them is a new shelter space with on the bottom floor with a 60-bed shelter with 65 apartments, a permanent supportive housing on top of it, and then also a modular building called a sprung structure on another site that is going to be a day center and service connection. So at the end of this year, we'll have our continuum of services will be outreach and advocacy to peer support case management and day center service connection to the 24-hour supportive shelters and permanent supportive housing.
Wow.
And we now have 70 employees and a budget of over $3.5 million per year. So we've grown drastically in the last 7 years.
Wow. You know, I consider that a real success, but also really unfortunate that homelessness has grown so much. And I don't know if you want to address that. We have so much to talk about just without addressing that, but go ahead and let us know what you're thinking about, you know, the economy or the challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that what is really important for everyone to understand, but I think is very hard to kind of grapple with as Americans in the society that we live in, is that over and over and over and over and over again, all of the data, all of the research across the country that has been done by various, you know, state departments of commerce, independent researchers, through research that was done with universities and, you know, even private corporations like Zillow and other corporations as well that have funded research, all of it leads back to the cost of housing in a community as relative to the cost of wages, the rate of wages in a community. Mm-hmm. And I know that in our community, often the conversation gets really twisted up with, you know, criminal behavior, or, well, everybody's, you know, addicted, or everybody's living with mental illness that's unmanaged, and all of this stuff. And what we really have to always remember and come back to is that it's the cost of housing as relative to the wages that people are paid. And if you look at all of the places across the country that have the highest numbers or the highest concentration of people experiencing homelessness, they also coincide with the highest increase in housing costs as anywhere else in the country. So that's West Coast, New York, Washington, D.C., some Denver, Colorado, some parts in Texas like Dallas and Austin, and some of those places have increased rates. And so, but what's really difficult, and so then from there, if you know that that's what's happening, then all of those other things are secondary issues. And they are secondary issues that compound very quickly. So, for example, I am somebody who has a long history of severe persistent mental illness, as well as substance use challenges myself. I was an addict and alcoholic for most of my young adult and early adult life. And it was only because of the safety nets that I had coming from a middle-class family, and the privileges that I have as a white person with an education in this country, that were made it possible for me to get the resources that I need in the time that I needed it to be able to get back on my feet and imagine what, you know, a life could look like outside of chaotic addiction. And if I didn't have all of those things, if I didn't have housing during that whole time, if I didn't have the access to the resources that I needed during that whole time, no doubt in my mind would my addiction have continued to spiral dramatically day after day. And so that's where it gets difficult at times for communities, because they are spinning their wheels constantly about all of these secondary issues and focusing on the outward behavior of specific individuals, when what we need to be focusing on is significant and deep policy changes to the way that we look at and commodify housing in our country.
Oh, so agree with you. That's incredible what you just talked about. And, you know, it's kind of there, but for fortune go I also. I totally get that. And I want to refer our listeners also to their website. They have, it's called IW Shelters. You can find it on Google it. Using shelter strategically to end homelessness. Why low barrier? Why some homeless choose the streets over shelter? So much in here that we could understand so much better. So, Meg Martin, as we go forward, I would love it if you, in the last few minutes you have, if you could continue to say things that will really matter to advocates here in Butte County, because we're so discouraged and we're so we're so saddened by what's been happening in our community, you know, with the divisiveness and a city council that does not seem to even acknowledge that unhoused people are human beings, much less want to help, you know, shelter them. Mm-hmm. So if you had a community like this, you were starting over, you walked away from Olympia and came to Chico, California, what would you do?
I would take a long nap.
No, yes, I'm going to do that.
I think that it's, okay, so what I actually think, especially to the tired advocates, right, like to the activists who've been at the grind and feeling like you're getting nowhere, or you're getting, you know, things are going backwards instead of forwards, I think just really coming back to that place of knowing that it is a sacred act to see the folks who are sleeping on your streets and to know them, to know their names, to know what their kids' names are, to know how they, you know, how they prefer to sleep, what clothes they like, what, how they drink their coffee, what food they like and what they don't like. This is like a sacred, sacred relationship and a sacred act. And there is so much that you don't have control over. And it really matters to focus on the things that you do have control over and to really come back to a lot. I do this exercise all the time with myself where I think about, like, what are the things that I have immediate control over? It's myself and how I'm showing up to spaces. It's how I'm showing up for other people. It's how I'm, you know, it's all those things, right? Like, think about, like, what are the things that you have direct control over? And then what are the things that you might have influence over, but not necessarily direct control over? And what does that influence look like? And how much of your energy can you put towards those things to still get outcomes that you're looking for? And then what are the things that are out of your ability to make a decision and that you don't have influence over? And I map those things out really regularly, especially when I get confused, because the challenge is putting your energy into places that are going to bear some kinds of success, even if the successes are tiny. And for anybody who's worked with folks experiencing chronic homelessness, the tiny successes are so amazing and beautiful, and it's what keeps you going. And anyone who's listening that does that, they know exactly what I'm talking about. And we, I think, as community members who are advocates, need to celebrate those tiny successes and need to understand that this is like societal structure shifting takes hundreds of years to happen. And we have to take a harm reduction approach with ourselves, with the people that we work with, and with politicians and systems and structures that we work within, because it's going to be incremental change, and there's going to not be, like, we might not see a huge shift in our lifetime. But when I look back from where we're at now to 2014, I, in my lifetime, can remember a time when it was only harm reduction-based punk street outreach workers that were carrying needles on our backs to do a needle exchange on the streets. And that was it. Those were the only people that were looking out for folks who were experiencing chronic homelessness. And now I look at our system, and it's completely different. And do we have so far to go? Yes. Is it a tiny drop in the bucket that we're building 65 apartments, even though it's been 3 years of work? Yes. But the fact that we continue to go and continue to recognize the wins when we do get them, it's really, really important. And it's what our folks, our people who we're doing this for need. Because I think just quickly, something else that often happens when activists get tired is that we forget to center the experiences of the most marginalized in our community, and we start to center our own frustration and our own anger at the system. But if, in fact, you went and just spent 10 minutes with somebody downtown, you would know that just showing up for them in that way is like a sacred act. Yeah. And, and I think that that's just like, and it's hard because you have to give up a lot of control and you have to give up a lot of your own ego and your own, like, what you think is the right thing to do to be able to stay in this work as a pilot light and not a firecracker.
Wow. Thank you, Meg Martin. Thank you for your work. Thank you for being with us today on the Peace and Justice Show. I just wanted to, this one thing about, oh, gosh, I lost it again, but something in there about how we believe that everyone deserves second, third, fourth, tenth chances, and try to accommodate and welcome every person who comes through our doors, regardless of their circumstances. That is what it takes. And you've talked to about us now about this long haul way of being in the world, and I so appreciate you. Thank you so much for your work and for everything about you. Thank you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's lovely to talk to you.
All right. Bye, Meg. Peace.
Okay, bye.
So we've come to the end of another Peace and Justice program with our incredible guests, and with my gratitude to each of them and for all of you listeners for being with me today through this journey. I want to thank our underwriters also at this point. I want to thank the Sons and Daughters of Italy presenting Fiesta Italiana on September 18th from 10 to 6 p.m. in the city of Chico's downtown plaza. This is a festival of all things Italian, including food, music, a wide variety of vendors, bocce, activities for the kids, and a raffle. Proceeds benefit Butte County Emergency Management for evacuation support and a Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For details, see squaredealmattress.com. And I want to wish you all peace going forward into this weekend, that you get some rest and take care of yourselves. And let's go on now to the community calendar before you welcome Playing Dead. Oh, I'm going to make a couple announcements. I do have 1 minute. 26th to the 2nd, Veterans for Peace and Code Pink will be doing their Band Killer Drones at Creech Air Force Base. Just Google Creech Air Force Base, Band Killer Drones, Code Pink, to find the details on that. And Occupy Beale will be September 21st at 3 p.m. at the Wheatland Gate in response to recent drone murders by the U.S. military. We are continuing to stand up against militarism. So peace to you all. Here we go with the community calendar.
Hey listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. Sons and Daughters of Italy, Vincenzo Bellini Lodge in Chico has created a Festa Italiana.